Hello, this is Tom Campbell. Today is September 29th, 2013. Today we are talking once again with Tony Andreessen and Mike Jan about The Trashmen, and we have invited songwriter Larry LaPole to this interview to discuss his contributions to The Trashmen. Larry, could you tell us your full name, your date of birth, and your hometown, please?
Larry LaPole. Now, I was born in Minneapolis on August 25th, 1934.
Larry, how did you first get involved with The Trashmen?
Well, I had been writing country music. I took it down to Nashville the winter of 1961. And when I got back, there was a strike at the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and I managed to slip in there to one of the artist jobs that one of the other artists abandoned. And somehow Mike found out that I was a songwriter, and he came over and he said, "I have this young rock and roll band, and they think they have a hit, because they've been playing it at all the teen dances with Bill Deal." Yeah, and it was a surfing song. And he said, "You think you could write a surfing song for him?" And I said, "I don't know a thing about surfing." Well, he said, "Will you come up to the house in
Lake Street,
and listen, give it a listen anyway, see what you think." And so we went up there that night, played their version of Surfing Bird. Of course, it's never the same, you know. It's always different.
The band played it live?
Yeah, they played it live in the basement of that home. I don't know whose it was.
The apartment that Steve and Dal was renting, or so they, Bob, on Lake Street, off of Lake Street.
34th Avenue South, on just off Lake Street.
They played Surfing Bird, and Steve kind of rocked back on his drummer's stool, and he says, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "I think that's the worst damn thing I ever heard in my whole life." And Steve didn't have a very good sense of humor, you know. So he turned to me, he says, "We don't give a rat's whatever what you think. You know, can you write a surfing song for the other side of the record?" And I said, "Well, I'll try." And he says, "Good." He says, "You got 2 days." And that was my introduction to The Trashmen.
So you're a country songwriter. Were you familiar with surf music at all?
No.
Okay. No. And Mike, you discover an article by Will Jones, correct?
A column that he had written with Will surf terms.
Will Jones had a list of surfing terms in his column one day. And that was about July 25th of 63. And Mike came over to my drawing board, and he said, "Here," he says, "maybe this will help you out a little bit." And so it was a great help, you know. In fact, if it wasn't for Mike, a lot of this stuff never would have happened. But I sat there and I thought, what is one of the greatest rock and roll songs that every band plays every night that they work? I thought about it, and I thought, oh, it's that Chuck Berry song. So I sort of took the basic things from Chuck Berry's song and took these surfing terms, and that's how we came to have King of the Surf.
Are you talking about Go Johnny Go?
No.
A different song by Chuck Berry?
Yeah. I'm not going to tell you what it was.
So did you play King of the Surf for the band live? How did you present the song to the band?
You probably put it down on tape. At some point it got on tape. You did a demo with you and the guitar.
Yeah.
That I think we still have someplace. And gave it to him that way.
Did you meet the 2-day deadline?
Oh, yeah.
The Star Tribune was based on deadlines. That's the way we live down there. So this was just one more job to crank out that he was able to do.
Okay, so now the tables are turned. Now you guys get to hear King of the Surf. And Tony, what's your reaction when you hear Larry's brand new song?
I love that song because it was different, although it had a familiar tone to it, and that was because of the melody itself. But he would change it just enough so you really weren't sure where it came from. But he had all of these surfing terms in there, you know, the hot dogger and pipeline and a double spinner and all these things. I'm not so sure that Larry knew what all those terms were even after he wrote the song.
No, I didn't.
He did it, and we thought because of what we were doing with surf, we had put in a fast guitar on it, and so that's what we did. And we started it off with what we thought would fit playing a surf guitar. That we didn't have a reverb on it. That's one of the reasons some people love it these days, is because it was so clean. It was so pure, you know. One of the things that really amazed me after the years and after I got to know Dick Dale is he said that was his favorite surf tune. Wow. Was King of the Surf. That was written in a day.
That's quite a compliment from Dick Dale. Now, was that recorded at the same session as Surf and Bird or not?
No, that's another story. That's the story nobody, or very few people know about.
Let's hear it.
Like I said, I was playing at the Black Forest Inn with a guy named Ronnie Brown. Ronnie Brown had the most beautiful voice. He sounded exactly like Roger Whittaker. You could not tell the difference between their voices. And so he could sing all of Roger Whittaker's ballads, but he couldn't sing a rock and roll song to save his butt. And so I agreed to play bass and do the up-tempo songs for him. Anyway, Ronnie Brown had acquired some recording equipment, and he had it in the basement of the Nickel Lake record store, which was owned by George Garrett. I still thought Surf and Bird was the worst thing I ever heard in my life. So I said, don't go down to K-Bank Studios and get ripped off, you know, with high recording rates, hourly rates. I said, Ronnie Brown's got some equipment. I said, go up there and do it. See what you really got. I mean, and he'll only charge you about $15 an hour. And so they did. That's the only time I can ever remember that they took my advice. They did. They brought all their instruments up to the Nickel Lake record store and went down the basement. And I was sitting across the street in Hill's Cafe with George Garrett. And after about an hour, hour and a half or whatever, Ronnie Brown came across the street and walked in the cafe. And I'll never forget. George said, he said, well, he said, what do they got? And Ronnie Brown said, oh, this is the understatement of all understatements. He says, oh, he says, just the same old stuff. Well, Ronnie Brown had made an agreement with George Garrett that if he ever recorded anything that did anything, that they would split the profits, you know. And till the day he died, he regretted that he had made that statement. Because what happened was, the very next morning, Amos Heiliker, who had a whole slug of record stores, he had an interest in K-Bank Recording Studio, he had a pressing plant, and he had the distribution nationwide. He had complete control of the music business in Minneapolis. The very next morning, he called George at the record store, and he said, have you ever heard of a song called Surf and Bird? He said, all these kids are asking for it in my record stores. He says, I don't have any idea of where it is or who's distributing it or anything else. And George, who always flew by the seat of his pants, was smart enough to say, oh, yeah. He said, that's my group. He says, that's my band. And Amos Heiliker said, well, he said, do you have the record, Surf and Bird? He says, well, I do, but he said, we'd like to do a little better job on it. So he said, I'm going to bring them down to K-Bank Studios, and we'll re-record it. That's exactly what he did. And I won't even begin to tell you how much money that cost Mike Jan and myself, because he immediately took over the whole scene, you know.
Who took over?
George did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he brought him down there, and he paid for a master recording at K-Bank.
George didn't pay for that first session.
And
no, he did not. And the reason that we own our masters today is that Dal's father loaned the money that we needed to record that record and to us, and we paid for that session.
Oh, you paid for the session. So
we did.
Just to make it clear, both Surf and Bird and King of the Surf started off at the Basement Studio and were both re-recorded at K-Bank.
King of the Surf didn't start out at the Basement Studio, only Surf and Bird.
Only Surf and Bird.
That was it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We left that Basement Studio never to return again, and that was fine with us.
Okay.
I think it was two different dates when either side was recorded. King of the Surf was done later on at a different session.
Okay.
Just a little aside, the reason the guitar was dry on that without reverb, Tony Zamp had gone on the Fritz and it was in for repair, so he asked me, can I borrow yours, which was a Gibson, not even a Fender, and he wasn't quite sure about turning on the reverb. I believe it had reverb, but he didn't use it that day, so the record came out dry on King of the Surf.
Tony, what kind of guitar did you use on that?
A Jaguar.
Ronnie Brown never received a dime from George. George had a tendency to always keep all the money. So he regretted it, like I said, till the day he died for making that statement. Oh, just the regular stuff.
So were you at the K-Bank session when King of the Surf was recorded?
No, I don't believe I was. I don't.
When you heard the song that they had recorded of your song King of the Surf, what did you think of it?
Oh, I thought it was great. It always sounds 100% better, you know, than just myself on a guitar.
Tony, who's singing lead on King of the Surf?
Steve War, our drummer.
In one of his different voices.
Again. Yes. Yeah, he was a man of many voices.
Multiple voices. Now, on the back side of the Surf and Bird album, the liner notes are by Bill Deal. Apparently, he's the one who came up with the name Surf and Bird. Is that correct?
We needed a name. We didn't know what to call it. It was a surf record, and it was a bird. And he said, it's a surf tune. You're playing surf music. Why not call it Surf and Bird? That's my recollection.
Just to clear up the mystery of the song, it's a combination of really three songs, Papa Umaumau and The Bird is the Word by the Rivingtons.
Mm-hmm.
And then the middle part that Steve put in, would that be accurate?
Yeah, but that was just put in. That was nothing that we had ever heard before. He just decided to do that.
On the spur of the moment?
Right, pretty much.
You didn't practice that?
Nope. We didn't know what to do in the middle when we played it the first time. And I think probably the second or third time he had to do something. And so that's what he came up with.
So the record comes out, and it's a hit, Surf and Bird.
Instantly.
Larry, the record you didn't care for becomes a hit song. How did you feel then?
I remember very well standing in George's record store talking to Tony. We hadn't been paid a dime. We knew Amos was going to pay George off and take over the song completely. And, you know, I told Tony, I said, we'll never get everything that's entitled to us if you let them do that. I said, I'll send it to California to this, who was that, Mike? It was a guy that was working for
Dot Records, I believe, a record producer whose name skips me at the moment.
He was up here from California to sign up a young girl named Diane Imon, and that's how we met him. And so I had his number, and I called out there, and I said, you've got to hear this thing. I said, it's a hit. They've been doing it at the teen dances for weeks and weeks, and everybody is asking for it in the record stores. And I sent it to him, and he called me back, and he says, "You're right." He says, "That's a hit." He says, "Who's got the publishing?" Of course, we were young and inexperienced. And I said, "I suppose Amos Heiliker's got it, or else George." And you could just hear the tone of his voice changed, and he, like, you just let the air out of a balloon. And he said, "Well, that's too bad, because that's what everybody wants, is the publishing rights." But I remember Tony, I told him we should send it to this guy in California, and Tony says, if we're going to lose out on the thing, he said, "I'd rather lose out in our own backyard rather than some stranger in California." Because I was going to pull a plug on King of the Surf, not let them have the publishing rights, BMI, airplay royalties, and because I could just sense that it wasn't going to work out very well. Tony said, "Don't do that." He said, "This is our big chance." And he said, "We, like I said, we'd rather lose whatever we're going to lose in our own backyard than make it up on performances, you know, on the road."
Because everybody we knew, they weren't getting paid. If you know, particularly in California, Dot and what was the other one that was really infamous?
Capital.
Well, Beach Capital Police would have been all right. It's just that everybody was taking advantage at that time. Everybody that I talked to, they just weren't getting paid. At least, and the thing is, too, you don't want to lose the moment because it was happening now. And if you take a lot of time and you say, "Well, we're going to talk to these people," and then they get it, and they decide, "Well, we're not going to release this right now. We've got another group that we're going to work on now." And, you know, you could lose the whole thing. Because I know people that had great records, and they signed a deal, like with Capitol, but all of a sudden something hotter comes in that they like better, and they shelve it, and, you know, the moment is lost. It's over. And I didn't want that to happen because people were going for it here. And they wanted it.
They wanted it.
And they want it now.
Immediately. Yeah, right now. So Tony was right.
Momentum.
To, you know, stay with it while it was on a roll.
So as of today, right now, who owns the publishing rights to King of the Surf?
That's a good question. They think...
it's listed as...
Willong, I believe.
Willong BMI?
But they don't own... they do not own the song. You know, I'm a terrible procrastinator. Mike will tell you that.
Yes.
Yeah.
You didn't procrastinate.
I have a tough time getting my taxes in every year. You know.
You didn't procrastinate writing King of the Surf.
Oh, no. No, when I'm under a lot of pressure, you know, and they give me the correct motivation, I can get it done.
That was a job.
So is it a mystery right now who owns King of the Surf? The publishing rights?
I've got the copyright on the song. I own the song. Willong, whatever is left of Willong Publishing, thinks that they own it, but I never signed a writer's contract with them. They really don't own it, but I own the song and the copyright. One of the things I did not, that I procrastinated on, but still met the deadline on, was... about 20 years ago, you had to renew the copyright on a composition after 28 years, I believe it was, at that time. They've changed those rules now, but I believe I was down at the Mound City Library filling out a new copyright form 6 or 8 hours before it was due to go into public domain. But I did get it in.
Okay.
And I still own the song.
And apparently you were put right to work again because you have two other songs on the Trashman album, My Woody and The Sleeper. Were those written under a timeline as well?
I think all of that stuff was on a deadline. Mike and I used to spend our lunch hours down at K-Bank Studio when the Trashmen were recording their second single and the album. We're both lucky we never got let go from the Star Tribune because we took some long lunch hours.
So you wind up with the B-side of the second 45, which is A-Bone.
Yeah, that was because of the kindness of the Trashmen. I don't know why they did that for me, but...
Tony, a comment on A-Bone?
Well, we thought it was a good song, and he came through when we needed songs. You know, Sleeper and My Woody is a song that's requested every time we get together and play. In fact, when we were going to Europe, one of the things that the promoters did was give you a list of the songs that you will perform when you go there. They don't want you doing new material. This is a classic rock show. And so those two songs were always on that list. In fact, all three of them, A-Bone, Sleeper, and My Woody, they were all on there.
Is A-Bone a car song too?
It is.
Okay. I thought so.
And they had great words. If you listen to the words now, when I, you know, what happens a lot of times if you perform a song and you, it was one of your songs and you tend not to listen to your own music, you know, you don't hear it. And when you're singing it, I don't know why, but you learn it and you do it and you're concentrating on other things. But when you really look at the words in those songs, it was really well written.
So, Larry, did you continue your career as a country singer at this time, or did you put that on hold? What happened?
I put it on hold temporarily, and then 1964, summer of 1964, I had worked for a guy that had a small bar in South St. Paul, and he wanted to buy a farm and get away from the city. And so that's what he did. He bought a place up in Lake Henry, up by Painesville. He asked me to come up there. It was an old roadhouse that hadn't been used for years and years, but they cleaned it up, and we started working there the summer of 64. The word got around, and pretty soon we had a good following.
As a country artist.
Country music, yeah.
But you continued to write for the Trashmen, correct?
Yeah.
So it looks like in 64 you wrote a Christmas song, so to speak, for the Trashmen called Dancing with Santa.
Yeah. I barely remember some of those. I know Tony was singing A-Bone over at the on Harriet Island. What was it?
Was it a ballroom, you mean?
No, outdoors.
No, when we went over there for the...
outdoor St. Paul Big Fest.
For the July 4th weekend when you guys played over there.
Oh, you're talking about the Taste of Minnesota.
Minnesota, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I was listening to some of the songs, and I honestly could not even remember the lyrics to A-Bone. And he was up there singing it, and I thought it was like a brand new song that I'd never heard before. And we were under so much pressure to keep writing songs for him, for the band, once they got going, that there's a lot of stuff that I don't remember now, like Dancing with Santa. I don't remember the melody or the... or the lyric to that one, and I'm still getting royalty checks from BMI for Dancing with Santa. I just got one the other day.
Sundays is selling it regularly. It's on their regular list.
And let's see if you remember the B-side of "Keep Your Hands Off My Baby" from 1965, "Lost Angel."
Oh yeah,
that was one you had written.
I remember that one very well because that was written especially for a lost angel.
And then we come to the final 45 by the Trashmen. Harry, it appears you have involvement on both sides. Green, Green Backs, Back Home, and Address Enclosed. What's the story on those two songs?
Well, at that time, there were a lot of people in Nashville were doing duets. And that was a song that was written for a duet for a guy and a girl.
You're talking about the B-side.
Address Enclosed.
Address Enclosed. Tony wanted to record that.
Tony Jones, that would be. Tony Jones and Nancy Montgomery.
It was a parody. Just a we didn't care what was, it was going to be said on the other side, because George Jones and Melvin Montgomery were recording together, and so we just thought it was kind of funny, and that's why we put those names on.
We needed a B-side.
Yeah, we just needed a B-side.
Is Nancy Montgomery a fake name too?
Yes.
Who's Nancy? Is the Nancy? I'll have to look it up.
Do you know the real name of Nancy?
I can come
up
with it.
That's a great song. I still.
Yes, it is.
I still am really fond of that one.
Okay, and let's talk a little bit about the A-side. Tony, did you want to make a comment there?
No, just if you want to talk about the A-side, that's a long, drawn-out story, too.
Let's summarize it. Apparently, you were imitating a popular TV and country artist?
Steve did that, actually.
Oh, that's Steve again.
That was Steve. Steve did that. It was a parody. We were having fun with it. We did it at dances, and everybody was laughing and carrying on about it. So,
and he's using the voice of
Walter Brennan. Yeah.
And Green Backs Back Home refers to the Tom Jones tearjerker song.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. The green grass.
Green grass of home.
This is quite a journey from 1963, Surfin' Bird, King of the Surf, to 1967, Green Backs Back Home, and Address Enclosed. And Larry, you're along for the ride all the way.
Well, 63. By 1967, I was back playing country again at the Excuse Club. The Excuse Club, or was that vegetarian restaurant down there where Riverside meets Cedar Avenue on the West Bank, right on that corner. There's a vegetarian restaurant. That was the Excuse Club in those days. And we came from that job up in Lake Henry to the Harbor Bar, which is where Grandma's
used to be,
is on
Washington Avenue.
Yeah, on Seven Corners, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah,
that used to be the Harbor Bar. That was the pits in the city. You played there for $8 a night, not an hour. $8 a night. The owners of the Excuse Club heard us over there, and they wanted us a couple blocks away at the Excuse. We stayed at the Excuse 6 nights a week for 2.5 years and tried to keep our day jobs at the same time.
So, Larry, looking back at your time writing songs for the Trashmen, do you have a favorite?
Yeah. My Woody is one of my favorites. And the reason, I can't play a whole lot of chords on the guitar. Tony took over on that one and put some really great chords in on the bridge that I did not originally write. It's just impressive. You know, it sounds so much better.
Tony, Mike, do you guys have a favorite song that Larry wrote for the Trashmen?
Well, we can't leave out King of the Surf, because that got the whole thing going. You know, that would be one of my votes.
King of the Surf or My Woody, I guess I would choose King of the Surf because of what happened with it. Everybody knows that song. Even in Europe, they didn't speak English, but they knew the words to King of the Surf, which is pretty amazing.
That's quite a compliment.
And A-Bone is not too
Surfing
shabby.
Surfing Bird
either.
And King of the Surf, that was a double-sided hit on KDWB. I've still got the little list of stuff, you know.
Top 40 sheet for the week.
It went right up to the top, both songs. It was a double-sided hit.
Both stations.
Which was very unusual.
I would say that's a compliment to the band as well as the songwriters.
It worked.
That's a pretty big compliment for me. I think you've got the... I think the Trashmen would have gone right to number one in the nation. They would have been the number one band in the nation if the doggone Beatles hadn't come over and knocked everybody off the charts. They were up... It was up to number two nationally when the Beatles came over in 1964.
That was a game changer.
Yep.
Larry, Tony, Mike, thank you for talking with us today about the days of the Trashmen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.